The chief commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says Israel's evil acts will draw it closer to collapse. Iran stresses the need for regional security system established by all countries in the Persian Gulf region. Also coming up, the UN warns that millions of children whose immunizations have been disrupted by the coronavirus pandemic are at risk from life-threatening diseases. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, the chief commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has warned that the Islamic Republic will respond strongly to any act of mischief by Israel. Major General Hossein Salami made the remarks in an interview with Lebanon's Arabic language Al Mayadeen television news network. Salami added that the acts of mischief by the Israeli regime in the region would expose it to real threats in the future. The top commander warned that the evil acts of the regime will backfire and draw it closer to collapse. Political commentator Faraz Nejim says the international community is silent about the Israeli regime's atrocities and human rights violations.
Backed up and supported and armed by, you know, all kind of governments in the world and regimes, and they have a green light to do whatever they want and to hit what they want, and nobody is ever penalizing them and holding them accountable. Right. We see United Nations is silent about the Israeli atrocities, their human rights violations, their their breaches of airspace in Lebanon, in Syria, even in Iraq. I mean, these people, they don't have any respect for any law, and they think that they can get away with it. We see clearly the IRGC Quds Force commander, when they killed Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, we see when he came out that time and he gave a statement and a declaration, and he had the flags of all the resistance groups, Hamas, Ansar Allah in Yemen. So this obviously was coordinated with all these resistance groups. So now this alliance is very well-equipped, very strongly working together, and the Zionist regime knows this, and they are surrounded by resistance, and not normal resistance. We're talking about resistance that has been resisting for years and years and helped liberate, like for instance Hezbollah. They liberated Lebanon from the Israeli occupation and from any other intrusions or invasions.
Top diplomats from Iran and Iraq have met in Baghdad and discussed boosting bilateral ties and advancing mutual interests of the two countries. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the matter with our guests. So Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has held talks with Iraq's Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi in Baghdad. The two officials reaffirmed their commitments to boost bilateral ties and advance mutual interests of Tehran and Baghdad. They also discussed about an ongoing effort to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and issues related to cooperation in the fields of economy, commerce, transport and fighting terrorism. Zarif also met with Iraqi President Barham Saleh. The top Iranian diplomat underlined the importance of the security of the Persian Gulf region with the participation of all regional countries as proposed by President Hassan Rouhani, dubbed the Hormuz Peace Initiative. Kadhimi, for his part, said Iraq doesn't perceive Iran merely a neighbor but also a strategic partner. Joining us is Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert from Madison, and also Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist from Toronto. If I can start with you, firstly, we're seeing more and more visits by Iranian officials to Iraq and vice versa. How stronger can this strategic partnership become? How can it influence the region? And who's perhaps behind stopping it from evolving?
Well, there's been an on-and-off, pretty close working relationship between Iraqi governments and Iran for many, many years. And the Americans, of course, That's why they've done such insane things as assassinations and bombings and so on and so forth. But I think it could probably get even more productive in the future, because right now we have an American administration that's largely admitted that it's lost, that is, it's at a loss. It doesn't know whether to continue with the Trump-Netanyahu policies of so-called maximum pressure on Iran and insane war against Iran, blaming Iran for everything in the region, and then not really knowing what to do with Iraq. The Biden administration ran against Trump's Mideast policy. But now they're in place, and they don't know what to do. They're hamstrung. There are Zionists in the administration who don't want a substantial change. And so, essentially, the region is going to have to work this out for itself. The American presence is weakening as the empire draws down, as the Americans turn to what they see as a mortal threat from united Russia and especially China, and face China's economic rise and China's move to become a regional power. That's going to take up the Americans' attention. They won't be able to focus on their games in Iraq much longer. So in the long run, Iran is the most important strategic partner for Iraq. And as events move forward, the Iraqis, I think, understand this more and more. And the Americans have lost their chess game in that part of the world. So I would expect that this new peace initiative would very likely lead to something very productive. And ultimately, the Hormuz Peace Initiative could be extended to other regional countries as well, the post-American Middle East.
Pardon me. On that note, let me bring Eric in. Eric, Iran has also, extended its hand to other Persian Gulf neighbors on a number of occasions with a number of peace initiatives. Why weren't these Persian Gulf monarchies, why weren't its neighbors that are more aligned with the United States, why won't they accept these peace initiatives from Iran?
Well, I can just back up what Kevin's saying, that the U.S. really is at a loss now. Its strategies have collapsed, and its only friends are these little emirates that really are just a handful of sheikhs sitting on oil or a strategic property that the U.S. wants to use. And they cannot afford to turn away from the U.S. That would be the collapse of their little fiefdoms. So they have to keep following the U.S. lead. And they seem more interested in making peace with Israel, even though it's going against Arab interests and on every step, but it's because they're rich, these emirates, and they like to trade in diamonds and gold, and they like their Jewish friends in Tel Aviv more than their Arab allies that they're surrounded with. It's a very surreal situation. And it's refreshing to see that Iraq is not, there was some concern that Kazemi might be just following the U.S. tune and trying to pull away from Iran, but that's impossible. Even if he wanted to, Iran is the closest neighbor, is the only really ally that Iraq can count on. So I was checking just on the internet, and there's virtually nothing about the Hormuz peace treaty, even though it's almost a year and a half old. There was India is very interested, and Afghanistan and Oman, and I presume that Iraq is on side on this now too, although it's not part of the Strait of Hormuz itself, but it's a region ally, and it's Iran is absolutely correct. It's the regional powers that have to keep peace. There's no room here for U.S. Right. gunships, and no room for Israel to play their games.
Gentlemen, I'm afraid we have run out of time. Let me thank our guests, Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert, joining us out of Madison, and Eric Goldberg, as always, author and journalist, joining us out of Toronto. We'll be right back. Turning elsewhere now, several UN agencies, including the World Health Organization, have warned that millions of ailing children are at risk whose immunizations have been disrupted by the COVID-19 pandemic.
The pandemic has caused several disruptions to immunization services around the world. New WHO data shows that as a result of COVID-19, 60 immunization campaigns are currently suspended in 50 countries. That means about 228 million children are vulnerable right now.
The agency said the children, especially in Africa, are in danger of life-threatening diseases such as measles, polio, yellow fever, and diphtheria. They noted that gaps in vaccination coverage have already led to serious measles outbreaks in Pakistan and Yemen. They said such a scenario could likely lead to more epidemics as regular childhood vaccinations are missing. The executive director of the UN's Children's Fund, UNICEF, also warned that routine immunization services remain disrupted in many countries. Henrietta Fore said that the world was losing ground in the fight against preventable child illness even before the outbreak of the coronavirus. Political commentator Abiyomi Azikiwe says the COVID-19 pandemic has to stop before any immunization plan proceeds, and this could happen through a coordinated international plan.
But what has happened with the advent of COVID-19 and the development of various vaccines, there is what the president of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, has said. Vaccine nationalism has set in, and there's a lot of hoarding of vaccinations in Western countries, in Western Europe and North America. And I think the World Health Organization is speaking on this as well as the United Nations. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is in Central Africa, there's been a spike in measles outbreaks, something that is clearly preventable. Overall, the rate of vaccines, the number, overall number of vaccines administered are down tens of millions of doses. And the COVID-19 pandemic has to be arrested internationally, but it cannot be arrested if the Western countries are not sharing or not, if there's no international plan for equitable distribution of vaccinations to get the virus under control. The virus has to be brought under control initially, then we could have the rollout of other vaccination programs, because what's happening is that the COVID-19 problem is creating additional public health crises among children and even among adults.
And the second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic is wreaking havoc in India. The country has logged over 1 million infections in 3 days alone, ripping the country's already ailing healthcare sector. Manawa Zaman reports from New Delhi.
For the fifth consecutive day, India has recorded an overwhelming number of COVID-19 infections. The country lodged around 350,000 fresh cases and about 2,700 deaths, raising fears of further devastation and dismay among its citizens. Many experts say the numbers are underestimations and that the real figures are likely to be much higher than the government figures. By Sunday, the number of total cases in the world's second most populous nation stood at 17 million with over 192,000 deaths.
India is witnessing scenes of utter mayhem amid a new wave of the outbreak. The hospitals have been overwhelmed and are turning away patients due to lack of beds and oxygen supplies, revealing the vulnerability of India's healthcare system.
Many Indian states have now imposed more stringent restrictions on people's movement. Here in the capital, New Delhi, the lockdown has been extended for one more week as the cases are soaring rapidly. According to some estimations, more than 300 people are infected with COVID-19 every minute across the country. A few months ago, India seemed to be doing remarkably well in handling the COVID crisis, but experts say election campaigns, gatherings, and opening up of markets and public spaces aggravated the situation.
What we see on the TV about government data on deaths or infection is nothing but just a glimpse of actual numbers. Many cases are not even being reported, nor the calculations are accurate. This is not a pandemic. This is the sign of the judgment day. We don't even have a calculation of how many we cremate each day.
In his latest radio telecast, Prime Minister Narendra Modi urged the nation not to fall prey to rumors and assured that the free vaccination program will continue in full swing. Indian leaders said this storm has shaken the country. Leaders from across the globe have expressed their concern and extended support in every possible way. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The U.S. Justice Department has announced a probe into Louisville police after one officer there fatally shot African-American woman Breonna Taylor last year.
Today, the Justice Department is opening a civil investigation into the Louisville Jefferson County Metro Government and the Louisville Metro Police Department to determine whether LMPD engages in a pattern or practice of violations of the Constitution or federal law.
The Attorney General added the investigation will also focus on whether the police conduct is racially motivated. Taylor was caught in the crossfire during a police raid on her apartment in March last year. The probe comes within a week after a similar investigation was launched into the Minneapolis Police Department. That after former Minneapolis officer Derek Chauvin was found guilty of killing George Floyd. The death of Floyd and Taylor sparked a new wave of nationwide protests against racial profiling and police brutality in the United States. Brings it into our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
The Saudi kingdom has ramped up efforts during Ramadan to stem the tide of charitable giving under the pretext of unifying relief efforts under the umbrella of the King Salman Humanitarian Aid and Relief Center. Of course, any aid that does arrive does not reach the most populated areas of Yemen. To make matters worse, the Saudi government has banned thousands of Yemeni expatriates from returning to Yemen to reunite with their families during Ramadan and bringing with them the money they've earned working low-wage construction and other hard labor jobs for the kingdom's wealthy. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ahmad Abdul Karim, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Ramadan Brings No Relief for Yemen as Saudis Block Charities. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Adel Al-Hajjaji is a proud man, but with a pregnant wife and three young mouths to feed, he can't afford to wait around for a miracle. Instead, he has taken to wandering the streets of Sana'a, gathering discarded plastic water bottles to sell to the recycling center near his home in Al-Rada. The meager earnings net him just enough to provide his family with a modest iftar, the evening meal that marks the end of the day's fast during the month of Ramadan. The meal usually consists of bread and water, but on occasion, neighbors will bring by salta, Yemen's national dish made of rice and potatoes, with meat blended in during more prosperous times. Before the war, Adel was relatively well off with a stable government job. He fasted during Ramadan without a passing thought about where his next meal would come from. In 2015, when the Saudis invaded and food became harder to find, he began to receive Ramadan meals courtesy of Muslim charities from wealthy patrons in the Persian Gulf. This year, though, Adel says those charities have told him they could no longer donate to Yemen due to the blockade and subsequent crackdown from Saudi authorities. The Saudi kingdom has ramped up efforts during Ramadan to stem the tide of charitable giving under the pretext of unifying relief efforts under the umbrella of the King Salman Humanitarian Aid and Relief Center. Of course, any aid that does arrive does not reach the most populated areas of Yemen. To make matters worse, the Saudi government has banned thousands of Yemeni expatriates from returning to Yemen to reunite with their families during Ramadan and bringing with them the money they've earned working low-wage construction and other hard labor jobs for the kingdom's wealthy. The kingdom has kept hundreds of Yemeni expatriates trying to return home detained at the Al-Wadiya crossing since March 24th under the pretext that their SUVs are banned from crossing the border as they could potentially be used in battle. Videos shared on social media show massive lines of pickups and SUVs unable to move, and reports are surfacing that COVID-19 is quickly spreading through the hundreds of families detained at the border. The Sana'a-based Land Transportation Regulatory Authority said in a statement recently that nearly 2,000 vehicles owned by families trying to return home from Saudi Arabia have been held at Al-Wadiya for over 20 days. Reports have also surfaced of widespread abuse by Saudi authorities, who are accused of beating stranded motorists with electrified batons when they tried to hold a vigil on April 5th to protest their detainment. Even the Geneva-based human rights organization SAM, which is often quite light-handed in its criticism of Saudi Arabia, spoke out about the situation. The organization claimed that Saudi authorities have been blackmailing families detained at Al Wadia, forcing them to sell their SUVs for pennies on the dollar before they can reunite with their families in Yemen. As Adel Hajjaji put it, the lives of Yemenis suddenly became the concern of the international community, particularly America and its allies when it comes to oil, as usual. Ali Mohammed Taiman, Marib's provincial governor, has accused Saudi forces of using their refugees as human shields, adding that they have refused all attempts to allow the refugees to move to safer areas. The Media Bureau of Yemen's army has released a video showing Saudi coalition military vehicles inside the camp. In a move that mirrors accusations against the kingdom in different places, local reports indicate that Saudi Arabia recently reinforced its ranks in Ma'arib with Salafist mercenaries brought in from different battlefields. According to the report, the fighters were offered $2,500 monthly. $100 of this amount would be deducted for document expenses. Fighters would receive $400 in cash initially, and the remaining $2,000 would be paid to their families after the move to Yemen. Meanwhile, neither Ramadan nor hopes that U.S. President Joe Biden will reverse course have offered a reprieve from the onslaught of Saudi coalition warplanes. Multiple civilians, including two children, were killed in a recent Saudi bombing in Sa'deh just one day after Biden announced he would proceed with over $23 billion in weapon sales to the United Arab Emirates, a key player in the war on Yemen. Human Rights Watch described the move as the U.S. backing out of President Joe's pledge.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Brother Ali Alevian and Brother Soheil Sarani. Brother Soheil, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Ali, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me here.
So Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, dedicated this new series of the program Viewpoints in the whole month of Ramadan to the topic which is rarely discussed, we can say, in the academic fields and also Islamic fields, and that is the book Nahjul Balagha and the significance of this book as tackled by the leader of Iran on different occasions and his different speeches. Before getting into the main content of the speech of the leader regarding Nahjul Balagha, I would like Brother Ali to give us a little bit background and introductory remarks of this book itself. Who is the author? When was it compiled? And what is the main content of Nahjul Balagha?
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Nahjul Balagha, or the Peak of Eloquence, actually is a book collected by Sayyid Radi almost 1,000 years ago. Sayyid Radi was one of the Islamic scholars, follower of the school of Ahlul Bayt. He himself was a literary man and a literature scholar. at his time. He was a great poet at the same time that he was a faqih, a jurisprudent.
Yes.
But he was very good, familiar with Arabic literature. While studying about the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam, he understood that there is a necessity of collecting some of his sayings and wisdoms and sermons of Imam Ali alayhi salam, which have not been yet collected till that time that he was living. He found this necessity and started working on this book, and he himself, since he was an author, he himself was saying that I cannot see, or I have not ever seen, if I'm not mistaken, okay. Because we are fasting, we have to be a little bit cautious on what we are actually quoting from this okay. great scholar.
And the other times, rather than the Ramadan, we have to take care
of. We can say lies yeah. very easily, yeah.
Quoting yeah. and giving references, especially during the academic works, are really significant. We have to take care.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sayyidina Ali, I think he himself, since he was a poet and also, as I said, a literary man, a man of literature, he said that I haven't seen any word more poetic, more with more eloquence than what I have seen from Imam Ali alayhi salam. That it, actually from a person rather, not from, I mean, he or others even said that there is only one more eloquent book than this, and this is the Holy Quran. Actually, here we are paraphrasing what has been said, that the literature or the eloquence that can be seen in this book can never be seen in any other book which were written by or which were said or quoted by people.
Mm-hmm.
So, he collected this series of sermons of Imam Ali alayhi salam and put them in a book, but he has not collected all the sayings and all the words and all the sermons of Imam Ali alayhi salam. He tried
to
collect those sermons or those words that had, to his own taste, a better eloquence in Arabic.
That's right.
So, what a pity if... what if he collected all the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam?
Okay.
Then what the human beings actually were facing with the words and, let's say, with the enlightening words of Imam Ali alayhi salam in this time.
And but, he was close in terms of time in the 4th century to the main resources of Nahjul Balagha, so that's, we can say, most of the sentences and sermons are authentic.
It can be more authentic okay. than one can be said or collected today, because
yes.
he was very close to the time of the dawn of Islam and the
okay.
life of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So this book is known to be the Akhul Quran, the brother of Quran. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Because this is the book which actually is closest in level to the book of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Okay.
And we have Thaqalain, the book of God, and whatever has been said by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We have in hadith that they are equal. And actually, Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, the household of the Holy Prophet, are actually the right interpreters of the Quran.
That's
but
right.
since we see
okay.
these words, which we see in Nahjul Balagha, or the peak of eloquence, actually cover all those topics that we can also at the same time see in the Quran, but a beautiful yes. interpretation of the Holy Quran.
And the sentences are not mere sentences. They are the words by a person who has been considered as one of the greatest scholars of Islam, a mujtahid by Islam, an interpreter of Islam, a Quran al-Natiq, a speaking Quran, and there's no one except Amir al-Mumineen Imam Ali alayhi salam on that time. We know that most of the people, even for asking their scientific questions, jurisprudential questions, referred to Imam Ali alayhi salam. So we can say that the words that Imam Ali had in this book, I mean Nahjul Balagha, collected in this book, as you said, are really correct, are very much near and close to the text of the Holy Quran. They are not by wahy, but they are, we can say, the practical example of how to apply the Holy Quran.
Yeah, it has been said, كلام فوق كلام المخلوق ودون كلام الخالق.
That's all right.
This is a word beyond the words of human beings and lower than the words of God.
That's all right. So, Brother Suhail, what's your take on that, brother? What's your take on the book, Nahjul Balagha?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, I say Assalamu alaikum to all the listeners and to all of you. You know, the point that Brother Ali mentioned about the authenticity of this book, I would like to give some additional information about that. you know, there are more than about 300 scholars have verified that this book is authentic. And starting from the beginning of the Islam till now, the contemporary scholar, right? And if you see the statement of Imam Khomeini and other ulama of contemporary time, or Imam Khamenei as well, you can easily find it out that you know, it's most, one of the most authentic book after Quran. And that's one thing. And the content itself says a lot about the book. When you look at the content, you can easily make it out that this cannot be said by any other anybody else other than Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Okay.
The content being with you know, a lot of eloquence,
yeah,
and the depth and all the covering all the dimension of Islamic lifestyle, all the dimension of human life, okay?
Yes.
With such an eloquence manner, eloquent manner, you cannot find it from anybody else other than Imam Ali
Muslim. Okay.
So that's one thing in terms of authenticity and the richness of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And this is great because, as you said, this book contains three important parts. Number one is the sermons.
Right.
Then are the letters of Imam Ali, and then are the aphorisms.
Or wise sayings.
Or wise sayings, as they say, short wise sayings.
There
of
are
Imam
about
Ali.
250 the sermons, about 250.
That's right. And the sermons are really great because they start with the creation of the universe and what's happening over there. And when you look at the text, see how much detail Imam Ali had on that time about the things that people usually did not think about, okay? I mean, the creation of the universe, the creation of the heavens, the other world, the creation of the human beings, okay? These are great things.
Well,
now, it was acting as a book of biology maybe on that time, okay?
I would like to mention an important point here.
Mm-hmm.
What Rehbar Imam Khamenei says,
yes,
in one of his speeches, he says this illustrates the level of Islamic concept during that time, and Islamic knowledge basically. So, you know, just by seeing it at the content of Najul Balagha, we can easily understand that how rich the Islamic culture was, how rich the you know, the knowledge was,
the concepts were, that's right,
during that time. So, and on top of that, of course, it was Imam Ali that, you know, he was as a role model a reflection of an Islamic personality, a complete man, as you can say, the perfect man.
That's right.
So from that, we can easily learn, like, you know, our rich past and, you know, how great the progress was made during the time of Prophet and afterwards.
That's right. A very beautiful quote by the late Imam Khomeini is that this book, Nahjul Balagha, is Nazile Ruh Ali. In fact, maybe we can say it is not a revelation, but it was sent down from the soul or the spirit of Imam Ali. It means it is from the very spirit of Imam Ali alayhi salam, all the words and the sayings. And this make this book very important for us. Also, the leader has tackled this issue in one of his speeches. And he says that the more the people, the nations, the scientists, the scholars, we can say the clerics, we can say, that's right, search about the main content of this book, they will find more about the useful things. And this usefulness of this book in today's world is important, Brother Ali, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really important, but unfortunately we have not actually benefited from the importance and precious the value of this important treasury that we have at hand. The leader of the Islamic Ummah once said that the peak of eloquence or Najm al-Balagha is like a complete and comprehensive prescription given by an experienced physician, but left in a part of the house, or for example, in close to the window, which is of no use for us, and we are not benefiting from it. And for ages and ages, we had it, and it was not actually yet read even by those who felt to be the follower of this noble imam. And we have been suffering from the diseases during the ages and histories and during the ages and centuries, but we have not yet opened it to seek help from it. So Nahj al-Balagha is actually a book of, if I want to compare it, make it close to understanding, is actually a medicine to all the ages and centuries of the human being. It solves different problems and different diseases of the human beings.
That's right.
Not only material diseases, even spiritual diseases as well.
Okay.
It has problems and solutions for personal lives. It has solutions for worship and the ways to actually go towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to the way of perfection. It has solutions for the leaders of the societies, for the policymakers and statesmen. It has actually solutions for our social problems that we have. For political political figures, it could be also a good source to take some lessons from. So we see it's true that it has been said, or it has been collected in, let's say, 1,000 years ago. But when it is read, we can see the freshness of this book that is still live. And this cannot be actually said or written by an ordinary person. So this book and the books like this actually can be said by only an infallible person. Look, brother, we see in our ordinary life a book that is being written by a great scholar. At most, we see that this book would be live and would be read for 100 years, 200 years. But do we have any book, for example, as old as Nahj al-Balagha and the holy book of Allah, Al-Quran, to be with people and no fallacy actually enters it, mistake enters it? So we see that this book cannot be said by an ordinary person, a person, yes, who is connected directly to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who himself understood the divine books of God, namely Al-Quran.
That's
so
right.
Such a person can write such a thing and say such a sermon that actually till today it opens the way and paves the way for those who are seeking truth and actually freedom.
Okay, thank you much, Brother Sohail and Brother Ali Alavian, for your presence in the program Viewpoints, which was on the topic Nahj al-Balagha as discussed by the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Dear listeners, visit our website at parstudio.com/Iran Call of Islam Radio. Also, YouTube channel, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
About you, IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Syria has condemned a Western Bank resolution passed by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, over the country's alleged use of toxic arms, saying the illegitimate move encourages foreign-sponsored terrorists to go ahead with their crimes in the Arab country. We now present you an article written by Robert Inlakesh, a journalist, writer, and political analyst who has written for publications such as Mint Press, Mondo Weiss, Memo, and various other outlets. The piece is titled, OPCW Ignores Critics of Its Cover-Up, Imposes Sanctions on Syria. Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, has revoked Syria's privileges at the agency, accusing it of repeatedly using chemical weapons during the war, yet refuses to properly address complaints of a cover-up by the organization over their sole underground investigation of any such attack. According to reports on the ground, on 7th of April 2018, an alleged chemical weapons attack was reported from inside Douma in Syria. Days later, the United States, Britain, and France bombarded Syria in response, without any clarification that any such attack had actually taken place. The significance of the alleged Douma attack was not only that it led to Western airstrikes on Syria, but also that it was the first alleged chemical attack that the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons had sent an underground team to investigate. Despite the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons now concluding that there was a chemical attack that took place, the leaked original report put together on the incident reveals that the studies conducted had found no evidence of a chemical attack using chlorine gas. Two whistleblowers also spoke out from inside the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, creating greater doubt about the credibility of the OPCW's publicly stated conclusions. A leaked engineering assessment conducted by the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons on the two gas cylinders found at the site of the alleged Douma attack interestingly found that the evidence had been tampered with. The first head of the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, Jose Bostani, has also applied pressure and challenged the way the organization has handled the reporting, along with experts in the field such as Theodore Postol, an award-winning professor of science, technology and national security policy at MIT. Recently, award-winning investigative journalist Aaron Mate addressed the United Nations Security Council panel, laying out a detailed analysis which he says casts doubt over the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons' current position on whether there was a chlorine gas attack in Douma, Syria. When, at the end of the meeting, it came time for the representatives from both the United States and Britain to answer a direct question posed to them by journalist Aaron Mate, both representatives had already left the meeting. An EU lawmaker, Mick Wallace, was also attacked as having repeated fake news when he questioned the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons Director General Fernando Arias and said the following. While we do not heed calls from renowned international figures to meet with all the investigators, he went on to state, this problem is not going away. Are you going to investigate all aspects in a transparent manner? It's safe to say that there are large question marks surrounding the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons findings. But what of those so-called moderate rebels in Syria, claiming to have witnessed the massacre of Syrian civilians with chlorine gas? The allegations of a Duma chemical weapons attack came from within territory held by a Saudi-backed terrorist group, the Al-Nusra Front. The terrorist organization, described as moderate rebels by Western media outlets, had a track record of placing innocent Syrian civilians, men, women and children, in cages outside of areas where terrorists were stationed in order to deter airstrikes from Syria and Russian government, who wanted to free the cities from the clutch of these Takfiri terrorists. The group also had been accused of starving and brutally executing Syrian civilians, on top of shelling civilian neighborhoods under Syrian government control and filming themselves opening fire upon civilian airliners. At the time of the reported chlorine gas attack, it was clear that the Syrian government and their allies were on the verge of taking the rest of terrorist-held Eastern Ghouta. The claims of a so-called chemical weapons attack directly caused Western airstrikes, as happened just a year prior when a supposed chemical weapons attack also occurred in an area known as Khan Sheikhoun. There was clearly a motive for the terrorist organization, the Al-Nusra Front, to claim that such an attack occurred in Duma, especially as they were losing the battle against Syrian government forces. In the case of the Syrian government, there would be no reason to risk committing such an atrocious crime when they were days away from complete victory, inviting Western airstrikes. This was simple to see with the most elementary level understanding of the Syrian war, yet these types of common sense arguments weren't even taken into account by the international community. Now, after ignoring all the credible critics, from journalists to European Union lawmakers and whistleblowers to the ex-director general of the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons itself, the organization sees it fit to impose sanctions on Syria for committing alleged chemical attacks. Interestingly enough, they note multiple attacks as their justification and not just the Duma attack, and when pushed on it, the Director General of the OPCW pointed to human rights reports to support his argument. It is clear that the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has taken a serious blow to its credibility and has decided to back Western imperialism over the truth. A shameful decision that serves as part of the justifications provided for the West applying its murderous sanctions on Syria. Moreover, Syria has condemned a Western-backed resolution passed by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, over the country's alleged use of toxic arms, saying the illegitimate move encourages foreign-sponsored terrorists to go ahead with their crimes in Syria. On Wednesday, 21st of April, the 25th session of the Conference of the States Parties to the Chemical Weapons Convention, the CWC, suspended the voting rights and privileges of the Syrian Arab Republic, accusing Damascus of failing to comply with the treaty, which prohibits the use of all chemicals on the battlefield. The resolution was passed by 87 votes in favor and 15 votes against, including Syria, the Islamic Republic of Iran, Russia, and China voting against. There were also 34 abstentions out of 136 countries taking part. France had introduced the anti-Syria motion on behalf of 46 countries, which also included Britain and the United States. The Syrian Foreign Ministry said in a statement that only 45% of the Chemical Weapons Convention's 193 member states, not the majority, voted in favor of the illegitimate decision, which is inconsistent with the OPCW's usual procedures. The statement by the Syrian Foreign Ministry added, "The Syrian Arab Republic condemns in the strongest possible terms the hostile approach embodied today in the work of the 25th session of the Conference of the State Parties in the Chemical Weapons Convention, as Western countries, especially the United States, Britain and France, practice the most heinous methods of blackmail, threats and pressures to pass a Western decision against Syria in a dangerous precedent in the history of the organization." The Syrian Foreign Ministry also complained that the countries behind the anti-Syria resolution have deliberately ignored the great effort exerted by Syria during the past 8 years, since its voluntary access to the Chemical Weapons Convention, the CWC, and the unprecedented cooperation it has showed with the organization teams. The statement by the Syrian Foreign Ministry said, "The decision is a message that comes in the context of the Western direct support for the terrorist groups in Syria, and it is an encouragement to terrorists to go ahead with their crimes in Syria, including their chemical crimes, perpetrated by these groups in all incidents witnessed in Syria against civilians." Separately, Syria's OPCW representative, Rania Al-Rifai, stressed that the resolution is a manifestation of support for terrorists by Western countries. Rania Al-Rifai said the decision was made based on false reports that contained fabricated and misconceived conclusions. "There is no doubt that this decision will encourage terrorist groups in their actions so that they continue to commit their crimes against innocent Syrian civilians, particularly with the use of chemical weapons." Syria surrendered its entire chemical stockpile back in 2013 to a mission led by the United Nations and the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW. Syria believes that false flag chemical attacks on the country's soil have been staged by foreign-backed terrorists in a bid to pressure the Syrian government amid Syrian army advances against terrorist positions.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.